This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, United leverages its Mileage Plus program to improve its balance sheet. One study says Amazon Air fleet will grow to 200 aircraft. A British aircraft carrier takes a step towards operational capability next year. And Southwest Airlines wants you to provide a customer health declaration at check-in. Also, the Finland fighter fly-off, flight sim hardware from Thrustmaster, and how old is too old to get your pilot's license? All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 609 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hello, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a fairly quick, nice, quiet show and some news about our upcoming Friday that we record this show.
Oh, that's right. Don't let me forget. All right. Also with us is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast, a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Well, hello there, and I'm going to just be quick and quiet.
Okay, good. Well, someone who is typically neither quick nor quiet is also with us, and that's our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
Hello, I'm your not quick reporter at large.
I think you've all got heat stroke. It's coming out. All right. Well, we're going to jump right into this episode with some of the news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready deep in the heart of.
Ready.
All right, our first story comes in from our listener, Linda. This is from One Mile at a Time. Surprising statistics about Mileage Plus, about United Mileage Plus. And we see that United has announced financing in the amount of $5 billion secured through the airline's loyalty program. Now, this is part of their plan to have $17 billion in liquidity by the end of September. Separately, CNN reports that that's three times the cash they normally have on hand. Of course, all the airlines are struggling, essentially, with their cash flow situations, and they need to have cash on hand. United is amongst them, of course. And it's an interesting strategy to take their Mileage Plus program and, you know, leverage off some financing based on that. And the financing is going to come through Goldman Sachs, Barclays, and Morgan Stanley. And United will have 7 years to repay that. But, you know, these affinity programs like Mileage Plus are big business for the airlines. United estimates that the value of their Mileage Plus program, if it was a standalone business, would be $20 billion. So there's a lot of revenue that changes hands here.
We need Dan back as a guest to explain all this because, you know, I tried to read how they mortgage their frequent flyer program to raise $5 billion, and my head started to hurt.
Well, I'm just thinking I'm going to leave the show early right now because I'm going to go start the Airplane Geeks Mileage Plus program. I mean, this is a $20 billion business. We're wasting our time here, guys.
I know. It's pretty amazing. So the partners, United's partners, pay United to award miles to their own customers. So this is things like credit cards and hotels. When you earn United miles or Mileage Plus miles by reserving at a hotel or using a credit card, United gets a piece of that action, and it adds up to quite a lot.
Yeah, I saw that a large part of it comes from selling miles to other airline programs. I didn't see them call out specifically income from credit cards. For example, a card I use most often still is the United Mileage Plus credit card. I would imagine they must be earning some money from Chase or whomever manages that card.
Even my my Hilton program, I have the option of taking my awards, my points basically that I earn from staying at Hilton properties, and I can either get Hilton points, which I can redeem for rooms, or I can get United miles. Well, Hilton kicks something to United for that. For Hilton, there's value because it's it's a service it can offer its customers.
If you look at the 1 mile at a time website, it breaks some of the stuff down. Like 71% of the cash, this is all for 2019, 71% of the cash flow is from sales miles purchased by third party partners. But then when you look at how it was redeemed, 97% is redeemed by using it on United.
Right, for travel. And yeah, only 3% of those miles are redeemed for non-travel rewards.
It does make you start to wonder if the planes are just kind of a side business. Instead, they're making money off of Mileage Plus, baggage fees.
Yeah.
You wonder at some point, could this be one of these businesses where, you give away the razors for free and you're making it all on selling razor blades?
Absolutely. I mean, particularly these days, but even, even without the huge drop in air traffic as a result of the pandemic, even before that.
The aircraft are just the promotional item.
Yeah. Well, in some senses. Them. Yeah. In some ways. So it's a really interesting business. It's not always what you think. We also see here that United has made an SEC filing, an 8K filing, and in that filing, we learn a little bit more about the program that United's Mileage Plus program has over 100 million members, and that 50% of United's flight revenue comes from Mileage Plus members, which is, that's pretty high. Also, the Mileage Plus program generated $5.3 billion in cash flow from sales in 2019, and that's roughly 12% of United's overall revenue. So, another interesting little number here is that the Mileage Plus program generated $1.8 billion in EBITDA, which represents about 26% of their total adjusted EBITDA. That's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So that's sort of a measure of earnings from an operating standpoint. 26% of United's basically operating earnings from this Mileage Plus program.
That's stunning. I wouldn't have guessed that. It looks to me like United better be very careful and make sure they pay back this loan. Can you imagine if suddenly it gets sold off and it's run by the Chinese or something?
That's what I was thinking, is that what happens if, bad things happen, this program goes sideways, and suddenly your Mileage Plus program is owned by Morgan Stanley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could happen.
Yeah, yeah. So, companies, corporations do... I was going to say desperate things, but I don't think I'd call this desperate. But they do things that they wouldn't do in normal situations when they're in a crisis. And quite literally, I think the airlines are in crisis mode right now. And so to make sure that they have the cash flow, they can pay their employees, and so forth. You have to take some strong measures sometimes.
You do whatever it takes.
That's right. All right, next item. This comes from Metro Airport News. Amazon air fleet to grow from 39 to 200 by 2028. And this comes from a report that was done by the Chadwick Institute for Metropolitan Development. And Max, they're predicting that Amazon Air's fleet is going to grow to 200 aircraft.
I've always been interested in the Amazon fleet, as we have three of their 767s that come into Stockton every afternoon, which is out in the Central Valley in a small airport where I do a lot of training at. And, you know, you got to wonder, this is really, I think, a brilliant move on their part to grow this, because ultimately it's going to, I think, lower the cost of shipping for Amazon. It's going to definitely be a hit to FedEx and other carriers. But why not go ahead and start creating your own fleet, fully integrate your operations, so you're not having to share money with other partners. So not of surprise that they're going to grow the fleet. I would imagine that in time we're going to see this to really start to rival the size of, you know, fleets of other cargo companies like FedEx and UPS. And what's interesting is they don't own the fleet. They use the same strategy they use for their delivery vans. They don't own them. They subcontract them, which keeps the cost relatively low. And I have read elsewhere that at least one of the carriers that they outsource to has fairly low salaries compared to what you would expect for typical flight crews flying 767s. And so that's obviously going to keep the cost low for Amazon as well. And they are outsourcing to, what is it, almost half a dozen different carriers, all of which provide some portion of their fleet. Got a pretty large network, and they're not really set up to fly the typical kinds of routes that you might find with FedEx and UPS. At this point, what they're mainly doing is linking their logistics centers. So that becomes an arm to facilitate all of their distribution centers. And some of those centers are located next to, guess what, UPS and FedEx. And so that also provides them some great backup capability. So if they find they've got overflow at some point, they can just move it to another dock on the other side of the property and have somebody else ship it for them. So I think Amazon is really doing a strategy here, which is going to promote a lot of growth. And pretty soon, I think we're going to have Amazon stamped on everything. I think they're probably going to run the world if this keeps up.
I wonder if they're taking advantage, if they've got the cash to take advantage of the current times and get their leasing companies to purchase aircraft that are parked all over the place, like we discussed, what was it, 4 episodes ago?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It could be an opportunity. And Max, you're right. There are 5 contractors that Amazon Air uses: Atlas Air, Air Transport International, Southern Air, and Sun Country Airlines.
So that would keep them from having to avoid Sherman Antitrust and being a monopoly or vertical integration.
Good, interesting point. Yeah, yeah. Now, we should mention, too, that this this study, and if you don't know the Chadwick Institute for Metropolitan Development, it's part of DePaul College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences, which is in Chicago. And it's an institute where students and professionals and others address a number of different issues, urban planning, design, and development issues. And this all comes from a report published end of May this year, 2020. It's called Insights into Amazon Air, 2020's Transportation Juggernaut. And so this is not Amazon saying that they are going to grow to 200. This is the institute projecting that they would grow to 200 in the next 7 or 8 years. And this is much more than previously estimated by others. For example, they note that Morgan Stanley a year ago had predicted the size of the fleet, and this doubles the prediction that Morgan Stanley had come up with. But they also say, quote, to support, quote, 200 freighters, it needs compound annual growth of 19.9%. That's according to the study. But they also say this is less than half of Amazon's growth rate in the 2016 to 2019 period. So the suggestion here is that, you know, they need the capacity and they have the money to invest in that capacity.
Well, I would imagine they could grow to a fleet that size and have zero growth, because what they're really doing is substituting other carriers that are already out there. So I don't think their present growth, you know, really is related to it. There's just a huge opportunity for them to switch. One of the things I think that really is interesting is, since they have 5 different subcontractors, they've really set up built-in competition among them, which means they're going to be able to keep the cost low. You know, my first thought was, hey, let's go start a cargo airline and serve Amazon. No, I think that would be an extremely low margin business to be in, because you're going to be constant competition, constantly trying to cut costs. So it wouldn't necessarily be fun trying to run one of those subcontractors.
And I think it insulates them from the two big boys jacking up their rates to them, because they can like, well, then we'll just, you know, grow our own internal capacity.
Yep. Well, there is an observation from the study. They list a number of observations, and one of them relates to this. They say Amazon Air's growth trajectory will make it difficult for the retailer to maintain harmonious relationships with FedEx and UPS. Amazon's decision to stop delivering packages not generated through its platform temporarily eases tensions, but the carrier is poised to eventually return to the broader business-to-consumer market. And yeah, I think FedEx and UPS would not be thrilled to see Amazon competing on that basis.
I'm not sure I understand. Who have they stopped delivering for?
For others. In other words, their Amazon Air is, as I understand it, is just delivering Amazon packages now, as opposed to also offering to carry non-Amazon packages.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, I was thinking of them as totally a captive carrier, but I guess what you're saying is in the past they've carried packages for other people as well and will resume doing
and
that.
Could do that in the future, yeah.
Wow, that would really put them in direct competition with FedEx and UPS.
Yeah.
And I think the one people who are going, oh boy, and seeing the future is our good Cessna with the Sky Carrier delivering to downsized markets and trying to, after the first 50 of those airplanes roll off their assembly line, selling them to other folks to deliver to downsized markets or smaller markets.
Yes, the Sky Courier from Cessna.
Right, exactly. I'm curious to see, and I'm sure we will, data eventually that shows how the purchase habits of consumers has changed as a result of the pandemic. In other words, it feels like a lot of people are buying a lot of stuff online more than before because they don't have to go out, you know. So I would be interested in knowing, you know, how much, what the increase was. And then I'd like to say after the pandemic, I'm not sure exactly what that means after the pandemic, but in the future, you know, does it ratchet back a little bit as people start shopping locally to a certain extent? But how much of that shift is permanent? How many people have decided that, yeah, this online buying experience is terrific? And so, you know, will we see a permanent bump up in the demand for transportation from FedEx, UPS, Amazon Air, et cetera, et cetera?
I'm kind of grinning as we're talking about this, because one of the things I've always hated to do for whatever reason is, you know, shopping for my own clothes. And for the very first time ever, I needed some new cargo shorts to wear. And so I went on to Amazon and ordered them. And I was commenting today as I looked in the back of them, the label says Amazon Essentials. That's the brand of cargo shorts I'm wearing as we talk. So, yeah, I think there is going to be a lot of shift in behavior that occurs.
All right, another item. This is from UK Defense Journal. HMS Queen Elizabeth ready to conduct carrier strike operations. So this comes after a 6-week test for the aircraft carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth, and it kind of takes the next step toward operational capability, which is planned for next year, 2021. And they expect it to then deploy with 2 frigates, 2 destroyers, a nuclear submarine, as well as some other support vessels. And, David, I guess the idea of the Queen Elizabeth is it would also carry a number of F-35 jets, they say including some Marine Corps aircraft, as well as a number of other helicopters.
The Queen Elizabeth is the Royal Navy returning to carrier operations with the F-35B, the STOVL, short takeoff, vertical landing version of the F-35. It's been working up, and it's now declared operational. So, but it hasn't been deployed to like a combat zone or a combat tour yet. But one of the comments you made was that there will be United States Marine Corps aircraft aboard it. It's capable of carrying 35 F-35 jets. Right now, the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force do not have that many. So one of the operations is to cross-deck between the United States Marine Corps and the Royal Navy. So they'll be deploying their F-35Bs aboard like they would a Tarawa-class amphibious assault carrier. So it'll be interesting that we will have a cross-decked carrier as part of NATO, you know, and the intention is eventually to have most of the cross-deck capability, because a third country, Italy, will also have vertical takeoff and landing F-35s. So they should be able to participate, and anybody who gets the F-35B will also be able to cross-deck with the Queen Mary, or anybody the F-35B will be able to cross-deck. Now that Japan's thinking about buying them also, they're thinking of being able to cross-deck with the Marine Corps also and the United States Navy. So it's an interesting prospect that these navies are buying common equipment and with the intention of actually using them as a common force aboard warships. We have cross-decked with the French. Their Rafales have been aboard our aircraft carriers, as well as our Super Hornets have been on theirs. But that's usually only a several-week practice. It's not, but this would be a long-term stay for the Marine Corps aboard Her Majesty's ship, Queen Elizabeth. So I'm sure there'll be some inter-service rivalry there between the Royal Air Force, the Royal Navy, and the United States Marine Corps, or the Colonial Marines, as I'm sure they will be called.
Colonial Marines. So does the Queen Elizabeth have catapults and everything, or does it have the ramp to jump?
It's got a ski ramp. It does not have catapult capability. It's a ski ramp aircraft carrier that's a helicopter carrier also, so the F-35B is the reason why the Queen Mary exists. It's much like the Harrier carriers that took place fighting the Falklands. They were all ramp. Ark Royal and those carriers were ramp also. So, yeah, you're not going to be flying F-18s off the Queen Elizabeth. I keep wanting to say Queen Mary.
Yeah, different ship. So
because no one ever calls it the Queen Elizabeth. It's a QE2. You know. So it's, but in fact, this is the HMS Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah. So is the Gerald R. Ford our newest carrier?
It is.
And so I guess that was delivered a couple of years ago, but it's still not all the systems are certified yet on that.
That's correct. The Ford is a much more complicated, much newer technologies, which have not been all that is they're working yet. The EMALS, which is the electronic magnetic catapult system, which uses electromagnetic instead of steam catapults, wow, as well as the electronic arrestor system. It's a very newer technology, whereas Queen Mary is a ski jump.
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth is a ski jump. More recent technology. The interesting class comparison would be the United States USS America, which is LHA 6, which is the landing ship, the Tarawa class, where they actually took out the well deck for amphibious operations and made it a more concise aircraft carrier with a bigger hangar deck for F-35 operations. So Queen Mary is a bit like our baby carriers, not like our super carriers. We recently had a photograph of the Ford working with the USS Nimitz off the coast of Virginia, and the Ford made the Nimitz look small. It is a big ship.
Yeah, and I see that at a cost of almost $13 billion. So these don't come cheap.
No, and there's three. There's at least two more on the way.
So one of the things that is mentioned in some of the articles that we see on this topic is kind of around the issue of are aircraft carriers still relevant? And, you know, they talk about how a century ago it was all about destroyers. You know, when you looked at navies and what was important to navies, it was all about destroyers. And then in World War II, it became clear pretty quickly that it really wasn't all about destroyers anymore. It was about aircraft carriers. So is it still all about aircraft carriers? And if so, for the same reasons or for different reasons now?
Well, you said destroyers. Did you mean battleships?
Yeah, battleships. Yeah, that's battleships are my Queen Mary.
And the answer real quick is yes, because it's all about power projection from the sea. And Britain's last two naval serious engagements have all been carrier-based. Mm-hmm. And the answer to your question is yeah. And, oh, by the way, the Queen Elizabeth is a really different looking ship because it's got two islands on it, you know, and it's really wide.
Interesting. So do you want to hear about the evolution of the battle cruiser and Trafalgar and all of that to go on after a couple of semesters of naval history? The answer to your question and argumentative to be against Launchpad is the fact that surface-to-air cruise missiles and now hypersonic missiles have the potential of launching a first-strike capability against an aircraft carrier, enabling it in warfare to take it out of commission before it's able to deploy its assets. Whether that will happen or not is the future to tell, but large deck carriers are, yes, a means of force projection, but you also have to be able to protect the aircraft carrier. And missile technology, over-the-horizon missile technology and hypersonic missiles have changed the perspective on whether a large deck carrier can support operations. Likewise, smaller deck carriers like the Tararua are much easier to deploy and more multifunctional. So there's the question of, do we want lots of small carriers or do we want big carriers? It all depends upon who you're talking to at the Pentagon and what theater of operations they are. But as it stands now, we will have at least three new super carriers in the Ford class, the Ford, the John F. Kennedy, and the third one, is the Enterprise. So I'm hoping till at least we get to Enterprise before we decide to not build any more aircraft carriers anymore. It screws up my whole timeline all these years because, you know, that never shows up in the 23rd century, but it would be good to have, you know, we've got the America back. It would be good to have the Kennedy back in the Enterprise, but there's lots of challenges.
All right. You know, it's too bad sometimes we don't have video because sometimes the hosts here do odd things. And the launch pad, what have you just put on your head?
I just went and got my flight deck cranium, the helmet you wear when you're walking around on the flight deck.
Very good. It may come in handy. No, you're too old for that sort of thing, but we'll talk about that coming up. But first, let's switch to one more story. This is about Southwest. Southwest is now requiring a customer health declaration from passengers before flying. And Southwest announced this. Southwest says that customers will be required to acknowledge an awareness of Southwest's face covering policy, confirm they don't have symptoms of COVID-19. They'll also have to indicate that they have not been diagnosed with or exposed to COVID-19 in the 14 days prior to travel, and that they do not have a fever when they travel. And so this declaration is going to appear during the online check-in process. either through the Southwest app if you use that, or on southwest.com. There's also swabiz.com where it will show up, and also on the carrier's mobile website. So this is kind of interesting. We've seen that, I think maybe since we've last spoke about this topic, is that all the airlines have basically said that passengers have to wear masks. And we've even seen some examples of cases where upon refusing to do that, at least one passenger was denied boarding. And there was another case in Canada where in flight the passenger refused to wear a mask, and the flight actually had to divert and drop the passenger off at that other destination, that point of diversion. So, yeah, Southwest is sort of stepping up the game here, requiring this health declaration.
Yep, it's an interesting time that we're living in right now. I guess the key thing is that any business can dictate, you know, who they want to serve. I mean, you see the signs when you walk into restaurants, no shoes, no service. Well, there's no law that says you can't do that, but any business can choose to do that. And if the airlines have chosen to do this, well, from a health standpoint, you know, most of the medical studies say that, yeah, that's kind of makes sense. So happy to hear they're doing it, but I'm sure there'll be lots of folks to disagree. But, you know, that's the way the world runs.
The weirdest thing about this story that struck me was that it's not from the Austin Statesman or the Dallas Morning Courier, but it's from Boston.
Hey, Boston's on top of everything, right?
Yeah, kudos for them, because you think this story would be coming out of the Dallas Morning Herald or the Austin, what is it, Statesman, you know, those guys who do, you know, are local for Southwest.
So Southwest has what they call the Southwest Promise. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. But this move requiring this declaration is consistent with the Southwest Promise. And in that, they say, among other things, that, quote, safety is and always will be the carrier's top priority from check-in to deplaning the aircraft. The Southwest Promise encompasses additional cleaning practices across the fleet and throughout the day, implements modified procedures to support distancing and contact-free interaction, and it equips employees with additional protection and policies to bolster their ability to safely transport Southwest customers and each other. So also as part of this, Southwest has said they're going to keep their middle seats open at least through the end of September 2020.
Well, as a former marketing guy for HP, I guess what I would also add to this is that I think it really makes sense from a marketing standpoint, because they're going to be at least some portion of their potential customers who are going to feel more comfortable because these measures are in place, which means they're going to be more likely to buy a ticket and go flying, and that Southwest and the other airlines can, you know, grow their business more than they might otherwise. So, you know, my guess is that requiring masks will actually increase their ticket sales, which is a good thing.
Yeah, they could. It could be pretty shrewd for Southwest to position itself as the, you know, amongst the safest of the airlines. But David, I know David always has enjoyed a good cocktail. I've recognized that ever since I first met David all these years ago. But David, that may not be so possible in the air.
Yeah, this story was sent to me, and I forgot to put it in the show notes, but CNN broadcast that, you know, that a lot of the airlines have been canceling alcohol on flights, especially domestic flights here in the States. It prompted a very long conversation with someone that I had, because believe it or not, I don't normally drink on an airplane. And I was thinking about the times that I have. I mean, if the airline decided that, like Delta or American, that said that if you're back in passenger class and not flying international, I'm still going to get my Diet Coke or my Coke. And I don't miss the alcohol. And so I'm curious if, you know, I know we have lots of listeners who live up in the front of the cabin, and I know that, but would they miss it? And is this because it's the right thing to do, it's the healthier thing to do, or is this a cost-saving measure for the airlines, kind of like selling your points? It's a very interesting prospect, you know. And the other comment that came out of my conversation was, well, that just means everyone's going to get drunk in the terminal before they get aboard the airplane.
Well, the problem is if you're drunk, they will, in many cases, won't let you board the aircraft.
Well, that's right. So it's sort of, you know, food service is probably going to have to change going forward on airlines, but it's sort of – it's interesting that alcohol was the first thing to go. You know, they're not saying water, coffee, or sodas, but alcohol. And I think that's because there's a lot of airlines that just don't want to deal with the hassle of alcohol in coach.
Is this an appeasement, maybe, or a preemptive strike to the flight attendants and the flight attendants, you know, union to make their lives a little easier?
Well, you certainly don't want to add fuel to the mask fights on board by having drunk passengers.
No, but
to the extent that people are going to get upset and you know, fight over masks, let's make sure they're not drunk as well.
Well, I thought that flight attendants generally liked the notion of serving alcoholic drinks to passengers because then they tended to go to sleep a little bit easier.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong.
But serving it back in coach usually means you have to go get the credit card machine and, yeah. You know, and it's one of those reasons why that I don't ever seem to want, I just don't want to deal with the hassle. You know, if I want a drink, I'll have a drink before I get on the airplane. You know, that will help me. That will help me sleep. I'm one of those weird people, you know, I still want to not look at the television screen in front of me, but I want to look out the window. And I maybe, even though, like Max says, I enjoy a good cocktail, I don't know if I've ever had a good cocktail aboard a plane.
Okay. That's funny. You know, I think that's probably driven. I'm sure that financially there is a benefit to not serving alcohol. But my guess is it's probably just driven from reducing hand to bottle to hand, you know, contact. Mm. I read somewhere along the line that some of the other airlines are now kind of packaging your snacks, you know, in a one little bag. And that's the only time you're going to have any hand to hand contact, not combat, but contact. Yeah. with your flight attendant. So I think that probably makes sense. I mean, there's still a lot that's unknown about COVID-19. But, you know, certainly it's entirely possible that there can be some transmission from contact on surfaces. And if you've got less handling of things between flight attendants and passengers, that's got to reduce that kind of transfer if it does exist.
So you give me my little bottle of Jack Daniels. I put most of it in my Coke, and the rest of it I'll use as hand sanitizer.
Oh, I'm waiting for the desperate of us to start drinking our hand sanitizer.
Yeah. End up licking your fingers when you're, you know.
That's good.
Okay, folks, just so you know, I'm joking. Yeah.
That was not. Glad to hear that.
That's not the kind of alcohol you use to sanitize your hands, as I recall.
Yeah. It's not enough proof.
And you definitely don't want to drink the kind that you're supposed to sanitize your hands with.
No, definitely not. All right. Well, Launchpad, there is a fighter fly-off taking place or going to take place in Finland. And I understand that you've been following this a little bit.
Yeah, we're in the final stages of it. Finland is conducting a fly-off to buy a new air defense fighter, and their selection program, Hotel X-Ray or HX Fighter, is drawing attention for its professionalism. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge Jamie Hunter's excellent coverage of this in Air International magazine. Finland is looking for a one-for-one replacement for its 64 Legacy F-18 A&Bs, which they took ownership of in 1995. That was 25 years ago. The project is capped at $10 billion or about $11 billion U.S., and the winning contender must provide a package that includes all the aircraft, 5 years of support, training, and all the infrastructure requirements to come with that in under budget. Since Finland has no indigenous aerospace, all contenders were allowed, and no one has a home field advantage. The Finnish Air Force, Invalidimat, my apologies to our Finnish-speaking listeners, has down-selected five companies to compete. Each competitor was invited to send two aircraft to Finland for a week in the winter months of January and February. Finnish winters aren't cold. They're professionally cold. Kids, don't try this at home. Each competitor was put through the same 5 days of flying tasks in scripted scenarios. The tasks included close air support, offensive counter air, quick reaction, and other tasks specific to the Finnish concept of operations. Okay, who came? BAE brought a pair of Eurofighter Typhoons, building on their demonstrated quick reaction capability as air defender fighters. But the Typhoons have no operational history of operating in austere environments. Dassault brought a pair of two-seat Rafale Bs, but the French and the Finns are being very tight-lipped about how they worked out that week. And this would only be the fourth military sale for the Rafales. Boeing brought an F-18E, an F-18F, and an F-18G Growler, demonstrating their commitment to the importance of electronic warfare. But the Navy has announced in the 2021 budget a curtailment of the F-18 Super Hornet procurement 2 years earlier than originally planned. So Boeing needs to demonstrate in their best and final their long-term ability to support HX, which may go out to 2060. Lockheed sent four F-35As, well acknowledged to be the one with the most expensive flyaway cost. Lockheed is proposing final assembly and checkout being done in Finland. With Turkey's ejection from the F-35 program, there are slots and business opportunities for Finland to step in and assume. Of the four Lightnings that Lockheed Martin sent, two were unable to even make it there because of lack of tanker support, and one had technical problems the whole week and didn't fly, leaving only one aircraft to demonstrate the Lightning's potential. Saab brought a single and a double-seat Gripen, but they also brought a GlobalEye, an AWACS based on the Saab's IRI radar and mission systems installed on a Bombardier Global 6000 long-range business jet as part of their bid. Saab is offering a total air defense package for their proposal. The Gripen also has a demonstrated operational history of operating in very austere environments. Okay, so where do we stand? The Lockheed F-35 is the one to beat, as the U.S. will be buying them until 2044. So it has the longest production run, and it's the newest and most technologically advanced. But it has the estimated highest flyaway cost. And with Turkey being removed from the F-35 program, there are production slots available for the Finnish to step in and purchase the aircraft. But the other contenders appear to us outside observers as having a much stronger demonstration week than Lockheed Martin did. Okay, geeks, why do we care? Well, the Finns are running the most level, open competition for a combat aircraft, and that's just fascinating to us, both as an airplane geek level and at the project management selection process geek, because they're keeping everything really above board and straight honest. Also, for our European listeners, whenever there's a competition for airframes, all the competitors show off at the big air shows, Farnborough, Paris, to fly, and the swag they hand out is just great. Okay, most of the big air shows are canceled, so look for the competitors to have lots of cool ads in non-traditional formats and places, and probably some really cool promotional programs that you can follow. It's going to be interesting. The Finnish will call for best and final in September, and they're due to make their decision around December. So somebody's going to have a happy Christmas.
That's pretty soon. That's pretty quick. We're towards the end here.
We're towards the end. The fly-off was in January and February.
Yeah, I just got to say, I just can't wait to see, you know, which fighter is first across the finish line.
God. Oh,
That's a,
the spirit of Rob Mark. Yeah,
and David Vanderhoof, too. I mean, you know, Mr. Pun there.
Someone had to say it.
Yeah, okay.
It'll be the Hornet.
You think so?
What Launchpad didn't bring up was the finish or neutral. And one of the biggest sales ever of all time was the finish not purchasing MiG-29s, but purchasing F-18 Hornets. The Finns, after World War II, tended to purchase aircraft from the Soviets. They had substantial MiG-21s. Ironically, the first real Western exposure to the MiG-29 was the Russians, the Soviets at the time, sending a pair of Russian MiG-29s so the Finns could analyze them to see if they wanted to buy them. They eventually went on to buy the F-18 Hornet. They have the infrastructure built in the Hornet. The Growler is an interesting thing because they are not part of NATO. They are a neutral, so they do not have any of the same force projections that, say, other NATO countries have. Boeing can leverage the F-18 by selling it like they sold their Growlers to the Royal Australian Air Force, which was, here's a bunch of F-15Fs. We're going to, like, throw in all of the hardware so that when you're ready to convert them to Growlers, here's a couple of buttons you need to add and some pods, and you've got Growlers with no real additional cost. I don't think the Finns will be in the business of wanting F-35s. It's too complex, and it's probably not the environment. However, Norway will have them, so there will be, and Denmark, so there will be F-35s in the area. Saab likes selling aircraft at ridiculously low prices to the point where that every one sale they usually make, they lose money on or end up buying them for the Air Force. Check out Brazil. And the Rafale has been a nightmare since India's been toying with it for years and the French just can't sell it.
French can't sell them.
The EA, I'm dating myself, the EAP. The Typhoon is, you know, it is a very popular aircraft, but I don't see the export thing. I think this one's going to go to Boeing because they sort of have the infrastructure already built for the F-18. The change from a Super Hornet to a Hornet is not that big of a deal, and the Finns are quite comfortable with their Hornets and have been for years.
I don't know. I still kind of like, I think the best and final comes back with the being able for them to assume part of the final assembly in country.
Yeah, they probably want a piece of it to generate economic activity domestically. That's oftentimes a big issue with sales of aircraft or in some cases engines, where they want some a piece of the pie.
Why India hasn't bought Rafales yet?
Yeah. Exactly why. Yeah. But it'll be interesting to watch, and it'll. Like I said, somebody's going to have a real fun Christmas.
Yeah, we'll see soon enough. Okay, thanks, Launchpad.
Air Force. Ilmavoimat. Air Force. Ilmavoimat.
All right, what's up with the geeks? I can start. We had an email from a couple of Canadian listeners, Brian and Cora. And actually, they wrote to send us a happy 12th anniversary message, which was really nice. Thank you. And in a subsequent email, they sent a photo of Brian with a T-shirt that he made for Oshkosh. And on the backside, it's got a big EAA, but overlaid that is this says, "Enjoy your freedom to fly." It's a question. "Then support your local EAA and ACPA, COPA, and anyone else who fights for your right and freedom to fly." So I started thinking about this. And Launchpad will be happy about this. So as you probably know, I belong to AOPA and have for many, many years when B'nai Wilson explained to me that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or a pilot to belong to AOPA. But based on Brian Zeman, you know, I started thinking about this and I thought, you know what, I should join the EAA. I just really should to, you know, show my support, to financially support. So I tootled over to EAA.org and I found that membership is just $40 a year, although they have a kind of a special where you can get 3 years for $99. So I signed up, 3 years. I'm now an official EAA member.
Yay!
Some people could say it's about time. Just think about how you support the alphabet groups, the organizations, AOPA, EAA, and there's, you know, a number of others too. I would just ask that you consider if you have the, you know, financial ability to support some of these organizations, that you think about it, and hope you do.
And as the president of local chapter 542, I welcome you to EAA.
Thank you. Do I get a local chapter? What is my local chapter?
You can look it up.
I'll have to find out.
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, there will be one nearby you, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. I just did this. I know there's a welcome to the EAA email in my inbox, so maybe it tells me there.
And typically, you're going to have a separate set of dues to belong to the local chapter. Is that true with you guys, Launchpad?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
And that'll, you know, you'll start getting the magazine, which is a really good sport pilot magazine.
Yeah, I've heard that is a good publication.
Sport Aviation magazine.
Sport Aviation.
Oh, did I mispronounce it? Oh, yeah, shame on me.
Yep. And I've got a copy hanging on the wall here. I used to be a columnist for them years ago.
Wow. Better be careful. Get those things right, Launchpad. Otherwise, you find yourself kicked out of the presidency there.
Yeah. Well, we've improved the quality of the magazine tremendously.
Now, you were – yeah, that's funny. Good one. Hey, you were holding up your badge that said boot camp. Tell people about the boot camp for EAA chapter presidents.
They have – EAA has regional boot camps for chapter officers. And it's a full one-day seminar, usually at like this one was up in one of the local airports in Dallas. And they go through what you can do, how to take the message, expand your membership, how to take the message out, what is the correct message, what is the wrong message. Don't scare your customers or your potential members. And also things you can do. Young Eagles. My chapter seems to thrive on Young Eagles, where we take kids for their first airplane rides. Other chapters are really strong in building aircraft, and they actually have a tool crib, and they actually have some of the bigger stuff that you might need to build an airplane, like sheet metal benders that you can borrow or come in and use. Other chapters are doing monthly, you know, having professionals come in and speak, like Max Trescott, about and give a little seminar on GPSs and GPS approaches or some subject that could be covered in a 2-hour block of instruction. And that's what the boot camp was, to teach us how to do that and also how to leverage the things coming out of Big EA Corporation. There are mass mailings we can do. There are lists, so your local chapter can run a list and say, hey, here's all the EAA members that aren't affiliated with a local chapter that are within, you know, 50 miles of your hangar.
Mm-hmm. Great stuff.
Yep, and different chapters do have different, you know, focuses. So, you know, I'd say, Max, check out what chapters are in your area. Go to a couple of meetings and figure out, hey, which one's the best fit for, you know, what you're interested in doing.
Yeah, great. All right. So who else has something going on, Max T?
Oh, sure. Let me mention two things. This one's not aviation related, but it's health related. So I just want to take a moment to tell people that, hey, I went and got my colonoscopy last week. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but for me, health is one of those things that I just do not take as seriously as I should. I don't know why women seem to be better about this. I had one 6 years ago, and they said, come back in 3 years. So naturally, I came back in 6 years, which was really not that smart.
Are we going to post that video on our website? Yeah.
So all I want to say to people is, you know, the U.S. Guidelines are that adults age 50 to 75 should be screened. If you're in that age group, you might want to just check with your doctor and see if that's something that you should do. It's not that big a deal. Yes, no. For about 7 days before, I had to, you know, limit the kinds of things I was eating. Not much. Couldn't eat seeds, vegetable skins, nuts, or popcorn. You know, that doesn't really, you know, hamper you, you know, too badly. And then for the last day or two, it's a much more limited diet. And then, you know, you've got some preparations you need to drink the night before and the morning of. But, you know, if you're like me and you postpone these things, there is not a good reason to postpone it. So I would say just make your appointment or, you know, see if that makes sense for you. So anyway, that's my my soapbox here. David, you're shaking your head. Why is that?
The subject.
He's visualizing the video.
No, the subject's kind of sensitive to me because I have one every year. And unfortunately, I have it with a physician who's a teacher. So it's sort of, we'll just say, here, feel this. So it's, if you are our age or older, you know, you have run a risk or, you know, get it done. It's like Max said, it's not painful. It's just, for some of us, it's traumatic only because it's like, oh God, oh no, not again. So, but that comes from
things heard with David's colonoscopy. Now here, you try it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
no, don't do that. You'll hurt him.
Well, yeah. So, and I just wanted to bring it up because I think, you know, health is important and, you know, sometimes us guys are just not as diligent about it as we should be.
Yeah, especially this day and age when, you know, there's the potential of other things creeping up on you. So it's important for all of us to stay healthy.
Yep, for sure. And the second thing is aviation related. So I just wanted to mention that this week on Aviation News Talk, I talked with Mikey G for about an hour. So Mike Goulian, and we talked about his flight school up in Boston, what he's doing with his wife there and what's special and different about that. We talked about how he prepared for the Red Bull races. And that was really fascinating. He had a regimen that was about 4 weeks prior to the race. And it's just kind of interesting to hear all the things that he did, including working with a sports psychologist. But our main topic was just talking about normalization of deviance, which essentially is that, you know, that gradual process through which, you know, unacceptable practices or standards become acceptable, you know, over time. And that's a big issue for pilots as well as organizations because, you know, sometimes pilots will, you know, start to reduce their minimums and, you know, just figure, well, I got away with it that time. And then, of course, they can ultimately, you know, lead that to disaster. So anyway, we got Mike Goulian on this week on Aviation News Talk and Launchpad. I know you did an interview with him here on the show about 2 years ago.
Yeah, I interviewed him right at the end of the last Red Bull. And he, go listen, folks. He's a good interview. He's a good speaker.
Did you say deviance or deviants?
Normalization of deviance with a A-N-C-E at the end.
Okay, not with a T.
No, I wasn't talking about Rob Mark.
Yeah, I couldn't tell.
That's where I was going with that thought.
If you're not here, you can't defend yourself. No, we love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
We wouldn't kid him if we didn't.
That's true. All right, we have a couple of shout-outs. First of all, special shout-out to listener Paul Mitrokostas. We hope you had a great Father's Day, Paul. Thanks for listening. We understand from Elias that you're a big fan of the podcast, so we'd just like to say thank you for being a listener. And also, Thrustmaster, got word that they've revealed a new flight sim range that's officially licensed by Airbus, and it's designed for civil aviation games like what you'd find on Microsoft Flight Simulator and X-Plane 11. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
It looks very accurate.
Yeah, have you taken a look at it? There's a trailer, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes too.
It's a throttle quadrant. It's the main part of the center console, and then because Airbus has side stick, it's their side stick, and they've got the little modules so you can make it so it's either the captain's side stick or the co-pilot's side stick.
All right. And another, you recall we had Dave Costa, Taz, on some episodes ago, the Renegade Aviator. And his episode 24 from season 2, episode 24, is a conversation with U.S. Air Force Thunderbird number 8 flak. And so you want to be sure to check that out. That's at renegadeaviator.com, which is renegadeav, the number 8r.com. Dave is always puts on a good show, and this one with Thunderbird number 8 is something that you might want to listen to. And then one more, and this video has been floating around actually since 2017. It's titled 6-year-old genius kid becomes Etihad Airways pilot for a day. And this was kind of floating around amongst us. Was it on Slack or in an email? Or I think it was in an email. And it's had almost 13 million views, but it's hysterical. And this came to us from Brian M, and he found it on YouTube for us, and so we'll put that in the video. But this is this 6-year-old kid who's having this conversation with the flight crew on an Etihad Airways jet, and the amount of knowledge this kid has about aircraft operation and all of that is just phenomenal. I mean, this is... You almost wonder if this, you know, isn't sort of faked, but I don't think it is. I think it's legitimate, and this kid is just amazing. I mean, he puts Dan Webb to shame. You know, he puts Zeke to shame. Sorry, Zeke. He puts Zeke to shame. I mean, because this kid's only 6 years old, and it's worth watching this. It's for entertainment value, if for nothing else.
Well, I think the aviation bug bites hard and it bites early. And you know, I don't know what it is, but there are some of us that, you know, just from an early age, we're just crazy about airplanes. So it's cool. I'm sure he will end up in aviation.
Absolutely. So,
and more to the point, you got to watch the crew.
Yes, yes. Because they're flabbergasted.
The dumbfounded looks on their face like, okay, well, maybe we should let him fly the airplane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So have a look at this. You'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it. On the listener mail, we heard from Richard. Richard sent us an email. He said, I'm a huge fan of the Airplane Geeks podcast and eagerly await each new episode. Thank you for putting in all the work for such a great show. Thank you, Richard. He said, I've always wanted to pursue a pilot's license, but work and family schedules always got in the way. Now I'm able to dedicate the time and resources to start the process. Richard asks, is there an age limit for taking the classes and then getting a pilot's license? I'm in good health and 61 years of age. Also, do you have any thoughts on finding and choosing a good flight school? And so we get that from Richard, and he's in southeastern Michigan. And... Max, I know you provided some feedback to Richard.
Yes, several of us wrote back to him. My first note said, it's common that many people don't start flight training as early as they'd like because life gets in the way and flying is rarely the top priority in life. No, there is no age limit. I think the oldest person I've taught to fly was 69, though he'd had some flying lessons 30 years earlier. The only downside of starting at our age is that it will probably take you more total hours to get your pilot certificate than it would for a 21-year-old to get their license, but that shouldn't stop you from pursuing pilot training. For selecting a flight school, I'd first see which GA airports are in reasonable driving distance. Don't pick one that's an hour away, as you'll eventually tire of driving 2 hours to get there and back. And I listed two airports which I thought were close to him. And I said, if those airports aren't close to you, then go out to skyvector.com and use the map to find which GA airports are located near you. And I told him you can also find out more about the businesses and flight schools at any of these airports by going out to airnav.com, and hitting the airports and then entering the four-letter identifier that you found on skyvector.com. And I also mentioned to him that I have a Learn to Fly ebook. And Max, what I'll do is I'll send you a link to that and you can include that in the show notes. That's about a 32-page PDF that people can download, and it just talks through many of the different considerations that they'll want to think about as they are contemplating learning to fly.
And Rob Mark pitched in some thoughts too, and I thought were interesting. He said he suggests students invest $50 or so to pick up a battery-powered aircraft radio to listen to the tower as the airplanes come and go. You might not understand what's being said at first, Rob wrote, but it certainly will after a while. And he also says that when you do find a flight school or two, ask them about taking a discovery flight that will put you in the cockpit and also give you a chance to see what one of their flight instructors are like. And then Rob also mentioned that Flying Magazine produced a Learn to Fly issue earlier this year. And we subsequently heard from Richard, who said that he went out to Barnes & Noble, that bookstore, and found a copy of the Flying Magazine special issue, Learn to Fly. And he's reading that right now and thinks that that looks very interesting.
Along with that, I have two suggestions. One, again, maybe go out and check out at the local airport and see if there's an EAA chapter, because there is a program, just like the Discovery program, called Eagle Flights, where we take people above the age of 18 for their first airplane ride. So you can, you know, if you haven't been on, you can actually see some of the systems and see what it's like operating an airplane in the 21st century. The only thing I would tell this, our good listener, is check your ego. You're at the same age as most of us. You've spent your whole life learning from people who were older and wiser than you. And you're used to a mentor who's old and wise and says, and there's probably a 70% chance that the guy you're getting in that airplane with is going to be a young guy, young girl, who is like under 28 years old, and they know what they're doing. And yes, they're building hours to go out, but they know what they're doing. And you need to check your ego that this young pup is going to teach you how to do it. And they know what they're doing. And it goes against your whole life of learning from older, wiser people. You're going to now learn from younger, knowledgeable people.
Well, and selecting the right flight instructor, I think, is a really critical thing. I think a lot of people will just take the first flight instructor that happens to be sitting on the couch when they walk into a flight school. And I don't think people really realize you get to choose who your flight instructor is going to be. And so don't necessarily just, you know, decide that you are stuck with whomever you first ran into. It makes sense to interview a couple different people and see who's got the best fit, you know, for you and your personality and the way that you like to learn.
Says the flight instructor of the year sitting at home on his couch.
Now, this is my office swivel chair. This is my new office.
Yeah. So some good advice all around. And thanks for asking the question, Richard, and let us know how you make out. Keep us informed. We'd like to see how you made out and what kind of decisions you made, what kind of issues you came up with, and how you resolved them and all of that. This is from Patrick Wiggins. It's about a pun. It's something that he received. So he sent along a photo, and we'll put this in the show notes. So this is it's a sign. It's one of those signs where, they put up the letters on the sign, to make up the words, obviously. But it's not permanent. The sign can be changed to represent different things. So this one says, went to the Air and Space Museum, but there was nothing there.
I got to tell you, when I read that, when it came through on the email this week, I sat there for a moment and went, huh?
I did too.
Did you really?
I did too. I was like, no, the museum's got all this great stuff. And then I had to realize what.
Yeah, it's air and space.
Exactly. I mean, we're just so literal, and we think of it as a building full of airplanes. We don't think of it as a building full of air and space.
Right.
But the second one is very apropos for our subject.
Well, the way that the second one came up is that down at the bottom of the sign, it says Wallingford Sign Company. So my initial reaction was, oh, Wallingford. that's like 10 miles down the road from me, Wallingford, Connecticut, right? So I went to wallingfordsign.com. Nope. It redirects to Seattle Propane at Wallingford Chevron. So this is it's a propane company. And apparently they use this sign and put up humorous things.
Their thought of the week.
Their thought of the week, right. So Launchpad, what's the first one that we found?
Very appropriate for our broadcast. Finland has closed its borders. Now no one can cross the finish line.
There we go. There we go. There's some others, too.
Well, let's leave them for somebody to go.
Okay.
You know, all leave right. them wanting more.
Yes. And there's even a fart joke in there, which I always appreciate fart jokes.
Hey, and we need to do a shout out to Wallingford, Pennsylvania, where I once spent a summer in a rented house there. So yeah, it's down in Delaware County, southeast Pennsylvania. They're not too far from Media. I'm sure David knows where Wallingford is.
Wow, I do. It was only a few minutes away from where I used to live.
Really? There's Wallingfords everywhere, I guess.
Indeed. It's an English town in England. Funny how that works.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, we'll have a link to Wallingford Sign, and you can peruse. You can go back in history, I guess, and look at as many of these as you want. And thanks, Patrick, for sending that in. It was it was fun. You know, hey, you got to have some fun.
Totally.
All right. That's our show for this episode. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Like always, we're at airplanegeeks.com. If you don't subscribe to us, subscribe to the podcast, you might want to do that. That way you can use an app and you'll be notified whenever a new episode comes out. Do you guys use apps to listen to podcasts? I use Pocket Casts.
I use Overcast.
Overcast, that's another big one.
Yeah, I use Apple Podcasts, but I also use Overcast when I'm QAing my show before I upload it, because the nice benefit of Overcast is that you can upload a file to it, even if it's not a podcast, and listen to it.
Yeah, that's a handy handy feature. What attracted me to Pocket Casts in the beginning was that it's cross-platform. So if you're streaming, for example, as opposed to downloading it completely and then listening to it. If you're streaming it, you can start listening to it on Pocket Casts on your iPhone, and then later on you can pick it up right where you left off on your Android tablet, and then later there's even a web player, and it keeps track of how much of it you've listened to. So, you know, you can use it cross devices, which I was doing a lot of the time. So that's pretty slick. But yeah, think about subscribing if you haven't already. Show notes, of course, are always at airplanegeeks.com, but we have our handy redirect link that will take you always to the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/609, as that's the episode number.
This is a reminder to Max Flight.
Yes.
Reminder to Max Flight.
Oh, what was
that? Friday night. Max Flight.
All right. Yes. God, we should have done this at the beginning, actually. All right, so this Friday, and what's the date, David, for Friday? This Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have another Zoom meetup.
June 26th.
June 26th. So David actually had this. This is a great idea, because normally we would be at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum for the Innovations in Flight annual event. Of course, that was canceled this year. Normally, we'd be meeting with many of you either at the museum or after the event at the Red Robin. We always do a sort of food and drinks at the Red Robin afterwards. So since we can't do that this year, we'll all get on Zoom, and let's see. So you need to know how to do that. So send an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, maybe subject Zoom or something like that, so we'd be sure to see it right away, and we'll send you the link and the password to get in. So kind of sorry for the sort of the short notice, but we'll look forward to seeing as many of you there as possible. We did it for our 600th episode, and we made that the episode. We're not planning on doing that this time. This is just a have fun together session. So hope to see you there.
Beverages, adult beverages.
Yeah, yeah. Bring your BYOB. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
They can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on that show UAV Digest. And if you want to know the other way to get the Zoom information, you can join our Slack listener team at and you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So if you're going to send us an email anyway to get Slack information, why don't you send a request also to become part of the Slack team so you can chat up everybody before and afterwards?
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, David. And, you know, a certain amount of stuff that happens around here gets into the Slack team first. So you kind of get some advance notice of some things. And, you know, you also have access to us in a sort of a different format than just sending an email, which is kind of nice. All right, Max Trescott, how do folks find you?
Well, they can find me at the usual place, which is at aviationnewstalk.com and on the Aviation News Talk podcast. The difference is I don't do any bad puns over there, but I instead talk mostly about pilot training and safety-related topics. And if you do go out to aviationnewstalk.com, just click on contact at the top and you can send me an email.
Great. And Launchpad Marzari, how about you?
You can find me on Facebook at Launchpad Marzari. You can find me on Twitter as Pilot Launchpad. And I want to tease everyone that we've been in contact with an aviation industry who wants to use us to do a launch of their product. Stay tuned to this station for future announcements.
You're such a tease. We're under an NDA on that one right now. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight, also on LinkedIn with David at the UAVDigest.com talking about unmanned aviation. In fact, this week's episode, the episode that will come out at the end of this week, I should say, it should feature a prominent industry guest. We're looking forward to that. And you can also find me with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com talking about the passenger experience. All right. With that, I'll say please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved.
And thanks for listening.